Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. Psychiatric medications have dramatically changed the treatment of mental illness over the past 30 or 40 years. Now physicians have a wide range of medications available to try to help people who are suffering from schizophrenia or anxiety or depression. However, these medications don't always work. Sometimes they work imperfectly. One may work better with one individual than with another. And patients do not always take the medication as directed. In fact, there is some reason to believe that something between 30% and 50%, maybe even some people think more than 50%, of people who take these medicines voluntarily are not taking them correctly. In this part of Focus, we'll talk about a range of issues, including some of the potential benefits, perhaps, and also potential side effects of these medications. And our guest is Dr. Gerald Kay. He is professor and chair of psychiatry at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, certainly, as we talk. If you'd like to call in, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, you'll want to use that first number, 333-9455. But if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana on the air or over the air, and it would be a long-distance call, or if you're listening on the Internet in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you're interested, you want to join the conversation, you just give us a call. The only thing we ask of callers is they try to keep their comments brief, just so that we can keep our show moving along. But anyone is certainly welcome to call. Dr. Kay, hello.
Hello there, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
In part, we are having this conversation because of the events that took place a week and a half ago on the campus of Northern Illinois University. It certainly has been a story that's been widely reported across the country, that this young man walked into a lecture hall there and killed a number of students and then killed himself. And obviously, we cannot... There is much that we don't know about the individual, and we can't, and you can't specifically comment on his case. Much is yet to be learned. We hope that we will. But having said all that, in connection with this event and others like it, people have raised questions about psychiatric medications and about whether they are safe. Do they have actually potential for leading individuals to act out violently? Are there particular problems associated with withdrawal from medications? So I think that what you want to do, at least here at the beginning, is try to ask some basic questions like that, not specifically about what happened in this case, but more generally. And so let me start with that.
Okay.
If you have an individual who is taking antidepressant medication or any of these various types, what do we know about the likelihood of violent behavior resulting from taking that medication? Is that possible in some cases? And if so, how common is that?
David, that's an excellent question, but the short answer is that there is no scientific evidence that shows psychiatric medications are associated with an increased risk of violence, or that there's an increased risk of violence when a patient abruptly discontinues a psychiatric medication.
Mm-hmm. So very clearly you've said that we don't have any reason to believe to date that taking these medications will cause people to act out violently. There has been, I think, some concern about the possibility that it might make people more likely to commit some of these medications, might make some people more likely to commit suicide or at least to have suicidal thinking. What sort of evidence is there for that?
Well, David, as you know, the FDA did put a black box warning on the antidepressants as a class. I will tell you as a clinician, and that most clinicians in the country feel the evidence is not overwhelming. You're dealing in part with a group of people that are extraordinarily susceptible to suicide, for example, because of the significant depression they have. But the data, we are careful about that, and we ask now more routinely. But in 30 years of practice, I have never been impressed with that personally, and most of my colleagues rather doubt that this is an overwhelming effect of taking antidepressant medication that increases suicidal ideation or risk.
Mm-hmm. What about symptoms that might be the result of taking the medication for a period of time and then stopping suddenly?
That's a different issue, David. Once again, when violence does occur following discontinuation of psychiatric medication, it's often not possible to determine if the violent behavior was due to the sudden lack of medication and or potential withdrawal symptoms, or whether the violent behavior was a core symptom of the mental disorder that was being treated, you know, initially and was simply improved while taking the medication, but after the person stopped it precipitously became uncontrolled. So that would be a good summary statement for the question you just asked me.
Mm-hmm. Just one more question, and then I have a caller, and
sure.
I don't want to make that person wait too long. But it has to do with what I suppose in the healthcare business people call patient compliance.
Correct.
And that is, this is a problem. It's not just a problem for psychiatrists. It's a problem for all physicians. It's difficult. It seems that there are a certain percentage of patients that won't take their medicine the way that they are directed to, and that may be any range of things from being confused about how they're supposed to take it. You know, it says take one pill three times a day. Well, some people have a difficult time figuring out what exactly that means. You also have a problem with people if you give them a medicine and they take it for a while, and you say to them, "I want you to make sure that you take this until you take it all." Halfway through, if they start feeling better, there are some people who would say, "Well, I don't need this anymore. I feel fine," and they'll. There's all kinds of ways in which people don't take the medicine the way that they're supposed to. And with these kind of medicines that we're talking about, you have the same kind of problem. And I have indeed read these figures that said, you know, maybe as much as half, maybe even more than half of the people that are taking these medicines aren't taking them correctly. They take them, and then if they start feeling better, they stop. Or they just say one day, they say, "Well, you know, actually, doc, I just forgot." And so there seem to be all kinds of problems. Are there more? Is it more likely that you're going to have a problem with patient compliance with psychiatric medications than with any other medicine?
We don't have data to support that, David. In fact, I have written a good deal about this issue of compliance or adherence. And you'd be surprised that there are some studies that indicate as many as 60% of patients don't take the medicines as prescribed across all medical specialties, not just psychiatry. We have very good studies that indicate, for example, by 6 months, patients who are taking antidepressants for their depression, really only about 50% of them continue taking it in the way that they were prescribed. And this is a critical issue because some of our illnesses are chronic. Some of our illnesses, for example, by that I mean that if you're a young person and you've had three discrete episodes of significant depression, we know from our studies that you're the kind of person that needs to stay on this medication probably for the rest of your life, because there's extraordinary probability that you will become depressed on frequent occasions thereafter. And we know that, and it's in that sense very much like diabetes, like asthma, like anything else. So that's an important thing to take into account.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Gerald Kay. He's professor and chair of psychiatry at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And we're talking in part here this morning about the medications that we use to treat mental illness, their potential benefits, their potential side effects. And if people have questions, you're certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Mahomet, and we will talk with them. Someone on our line number one. Hello.
Yes. Am I on?
Yes.
I would like to ask you, sir, in the 50s, when all the mental institutions were shut down and disbanded, the psychiatric community said they would be better in the community which of course they're not. 30% of the homeless now are mental patients. And if the family and community elements could have taken care of this problem, they would have been there in the first place. I worked in a mental institution in the 50s. It was very well run. They did a very good job. This was 100,000 patients. And you did not have all these problems. They did a very good job. Would you recommend that we have mental institutions, permanent mental institutions, again? I'll wait for your answer.
That was an eloquent question. And it's a very timely one because here in my home city, they are now my local state mental hospital. So I'm very much aware of these issues. You're raising a very important issue, and most of the young listeners may not be aware of it as you are, which is that the deinstitutionalization movement that took place in the 60s and early 70s essentially moved many, many patients traditionally treated in the longer-term state hospital system into what they called least restricted environment or least restricted experiences of care. And so many state institutions were closed down, or the population of those institutions dropped dramatically. There are a number of us who feel strongly that while this may have had very important benefits, there were many communities who were ill, which were ill prepared to handle the number of people who were then to be coming under the aegis of the community mental health system. And I think we have continued to struggle with that even 30 years later. So I think your point is well taken. We are trying throughout the country, but with decreased resources, stigma, all of these things make it very, very challenging to deliver the kind of services for some people who were better off in longer-term facilities.
Hmm. Let me just steer this to a point that I know that you're concerned about. I'm sure other people in your field are. And that is our growing tendency, for a number of reasons that are well understood, to approach the treatment of individuals with mental illness with mostly medication and perhaps a little bit of therapy, but not much. And the argument that that's not going to be the most effective way to provide relief. You may do a little bit of symptom relief, but if that's all you're doing, that you're still going to have a person with a problem, and that if you don't give them some kind of therapy in addition to the medication, that's an incomplete treatment.
A very, very central issue that you've just raised, and once again, I've written a lot about that too, but to make a long story short, there is not an illness in the psychiatry diagnostic system that I'm aware of that is better treated than when we combine both psychotherapy and medication when indicated. I'm including schizophrenia, where all the studies in the last 25 years have been extraordinarily convincing, demonstrating that if you don't have the psychoeducational interventions, working with families, all kinds of things like that, the recidivism, that is to say the readmission to mental hospitals for people with schizophrenia, is dramatically higher. The same for bipolar disorder, the same for virtually every kind of psychiatric disorder. It's not an either-or, and the best treatment effects appear by and large, there are some exceptions, but by and large, when the treatment is so-called combined or integrated, when both medication and psychotherapy are used simultaneously.
And obviously here the problem that everyone, I'm sure, is aware of is if we ask this question, why are people perhaps able to get medication, but they're have no or limited access to therapy, it is because either they can't afford it themselves or their care is provided by some kind of insurance provider, and that provider says, yeah, we'll provide you this much care, but no more.
Well, I almost feel you didn't need me on the show today, David. It sounds to me like you're very knowledgeable. Well, we began struggling with this in the late 80s when managed behavioral care, managed care in general, got to psychiatry before it got to the other specialties. And again, to make a very long story short, you're absolutely correct. Although there's no data that is convincing that supports what happens when you split treatment between, let's say, psychiatrists and other mental health professionals, that it's more effective. There is no data. Nevertheless, the financial aspect of managed care really pushed us in a direction that I feel ultimately was very self-defeating and very short-sighted, which was to split the medication off to psychiatrists who were then obligated to see patients for, let's say, 10 or 15 minutes, and that the psychotherapy was done by other professionals or caregivers. And this model has turned out, I feel, this is a personal feeling, to be a very ineffective way to go. And as I said once before, there's no data to suggest that it's more effective this way. In fact, there are some studies that indicate that it's less effective. That one, when, let's say, a psychiatrist treats certain things like depression, there are less costs and the patients get better. So this has been an issue. The financial part has driven this system. The other issue of recent has been the fact that the 1990s has produced such a negative feeling in managed care with certain psychiatrists that they're having harder and harder time getting an expert panel of psychiatrists to even join these managed care panels at this point in time. So that many of the psychiatrists who are in those care panels are relegated to really just medication management and nothing more than that.
Well, do we though have to say that that it might not be the ideal, it might not be what we would want, but that if we have an individual that is getting medication, that and maybe a little bit of therapy, not enough, but maybe a little, maybe they're just getting medication, that that's better than nothing.
I agree, it is better than nothing. I just want you to know that it's one thing to treat the depression symptoms so that people get a lot better. It's another thing for them to recover completely. Mm-hmm. And that's an important distinction to make. So there isn't any question that in all instances where the resources are limited, if you had the opportunity, you of course would give someone who is depressed medication. But for a certain number of people, they don't respond to medication alone, and that's an important issue.
Yeah. I'm sure that you would agree, and other doctors would agree, that for many patients who are suffering mental illness, if you can match the right person with the right medication,
mm-hmm.
that can be very beneficial in helping to reduce their symptoms and make it easier for them to live their lives. At the same time, some of these medications can have problematic side effects, and I suppose that among the reasons that people give for not taking their medication, that is going to be one of them. People are going to say, I just don't like the way that this medication makes me feel.
Sure.
Is that something where you either have to say to the patient, well, you're going to have to live with this and hope that they're willing to put up with it, or is it the case that you might be able to try a different medication and you could get the same or reasonably equivalent effect in terms of symptom control and not have the kind of side effects?
Yes. Again, another significant question. We have so many of the new medications in our therapeutic armamentarium now that if we can't get a response on one medication, there are so many different options that we can use. So that side effects, by the way, for certain compounds like the antidepressants are very short-lived. A lot of them, for example, in the first 7 to 10 days or so, might give you a little GI upset, maybe some headaches, and things like that. But for the most part, for the vast majority of people, those dissipate after the first week or 10 days. There are only a couple of side effects that persist that would cause me to change, for example, medications that I was using to treat depression. And they have to do with if a person became agitated on the medication, I would want to switch to another one. Or number two, perhaps the most persisting or enduring side effect is, of course, the sexual side effects for both men and women. And then we do have to sort of play around and find the right combination to minimize, for example, the sexual side effects. The same is true with a class of compounds called mood stabilizers for people who we treat bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness. We have so many of those that that if we have side effects in the first medication, we're not really thwarted. We can try other medications until we finally hit the right selection for that patient.
Mm-hmm. In how often is the problem here with people taking their medication also has something to do with either the that people don't, they would not like it widely known by family, friends, that they're taking it, or that it has something to do with people's attitude about being ill. Either they know that they're ill and they don't want people to know, or that they may be ill but they don't want to admit that to themselves. It's all bound up in the way people feel about being sick and whether they want to admit it or not to themselves or anybody else.
David, you should inform your audience that you and I have not talked prior to this interview, because once again you've hit on an extraordinarily central issue, that much of the problem with compliance has to do with the meaning that people attribute to medications. All medications for almost all patients have certain meanings for them. Most often they're outside of their awareness, but when it comes to psychotropic medication or psychiatric medication, these are very, very significant issues. Because, just as you said, people have beliefs about medications. A, they may not work. Medications are dangerous. Medications are only for really, really, really sick people. Medication should only be considered as a last resort. Medication should only be taken when someone is really feeling bad or sick. Or they may have certain thoughts about the medications, for example, don't really help anything because there's no such thing as mental illness. It's all a weakness, a moral weakness. Or it's a terrible thing to have a need to treat a mental illness. Or I can ignore my symptoms, it'll go away eventually. Or mental illness can't be cured. All of these kinds of things play into what I've talked about in terms of the meaning that patients ascribe to medication and mental illness. They are very, very, very important in the contribution towards this issue of compliance.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here, someone listening in the nearby community of Rantoul. Sure. So let's talk with them. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate your guest being here today, because I'm bipolar and I'm 57, been in the mental health system wherever I've lived since I was 20. And just the last 5 years, I've had continuity of care and continuity of meds. So my life has been very stable. But one of the things you said triggered a distant memory, and that was sexual dysfunction. Or I should say, I have no libido left.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so dependent on my meds. I shouldn't say dependent. I don't mean that in a addict sort of way.
Right. Uh-huh.
My life is so good now.
Yes.
That I hesitate to ask the doctor to change my medications. I sure don't want to wind up back in the hospital. Is there a medication or a series of medications that are available for women that could added to my med mix to sort of bring that back?
Mm. You're raising another of very important questions. I must say I'm very impressed with the sophistication of your audience. The first issue I want to talk about is the continuity of care. That is such an important issue that you raised, and that's one of the problems that we're having, for example, in college mental health. What happens when a high school youngster with an illness or disorder gets to college and there is no continuity of care? What happens when certain institutions or agencies close down and people have to change doctors and medicines get changed when may not have been appropriate or in the best interest of the patient? So the continuity of care is an absolutely vital issue that you raised. The second issue is, are there times when one has to make compromises? Are there times when, in order for a patient no longer to have manic episodes or profoundly depressing episodes if they're bipolar, would there be some need to tolerate some of the side effects? And the answer to that question is yes. It's always a trade-off. What's the cost-benefit analysis? Now, having said that, people are working diligently now to try to find some medications that counteract these sexual side effects. But in general, there's not one cure-all for this kind of thing. Sometimes we can lower the dose a little bit, and it helps a little bit. Sometimes we can try other kinds of things. But in general, I don't have one particular medication that will do away with these sexual side effects.
Bummer.
Sorry, but it's not something to be able to give you better.
It's something you should talk with your doctor about, though. I'm not feeling comfortable in giving you advice about changing meds or adding medications, but since the doctor-patient relationship you described is obviously so important and so helpful, I don't want to mess up that therapeutic alliance, but I should raise the question with him or her.
I will, and I sure appreciate the advice, although it has depressed me.
I know, and there are some things we can do, but they're a little bit hit and miss. And that's why I want you to talk to your doctor about it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, I guess we should be clear that when you're talking about sexual side effects, basically here what we're talking about is lack of interest.
Not only that, but we're talking about, in the case of the antidepressants, a sexual dysfunction like delayed ejaculation in men, or delayed orgasmic response in women as well.
Yeah. And I don't want to be accused of bad-mouthing a medical profession here, but I wonder, in fact, how sympathetic doctors are to these kind of complaints from patients. I can imagine a doctor saying, look, we've got good control of your symptoms and you're managing to live your life pretty well. You're asking for too much if you're saying to me, yes, doc, that's great, but I also want to have a normal sex life.
Yeah, not my practice. It's not a matter of bad sympathy. It's a matter of empathy to appreciate this is an important part of people's lives. And no, I would never talk to a patient and say, stop your complaining, in essence. The issue is we would have to find a way that would make it less problematic. It's a major issue, and if I would be not very helpful to my patients if I wrote it off and said, you know, hey, what do you want? You're wanting too much. We have to work and find a way that will enhance and alleviate some of those problems. So, no, I don't take it that way. I take it as a challenge that both the patient and I will work together to find some ways to lessen these side effects.
Well, again, we have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Gerald Kay. He's a professor and chair of psychiatry at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And we're talking about some of the medications used to treat mental illnesses, what they can do, what they can't, potential side effects. And again, I should mention it as I often do when we have physicians here on the program that obviously we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone. So general information perhaps, but specific information about your case, obviously that's something that you're going to have to talk about with your own physician. But I also don't want to discourage people from calling if they have questions. 333-9455. And toll free 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I have a little bit of disagreement with the doctor. I have trouble responding to medications. I'm overly sensitive. A lot of them don't work on me because of side effects. I see more side effects than sex and agitation on a lot of these meds. Two of them, which one is dizziness and lightheadedness, and another one is lack of motivation, a dulling of feelings, which is a huge issue for me. It's kind of an emotional detachment. I refer to worse pills, best pills, which is a big help to me. Then the other problem is that the HMOs limit me to 12 minutes with a psychiatrist, which is not good at all when you're dealing with complicated meds and complicated physical sensitivity.
Yeah. Well, that's a very challenging situation. I'll go out on a limb and just since we haven't identified you, are you being treated for bipolar disorder?
No, anxiety and depression.
Okay, so the dullness then you're referring to is what you feel the antidepressant makes you feel.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
and
we
have... Remeron.
Okay, well...
Caused lightheadedness.
Well, you know, again, without getting into the specific pharmacotherapy here, Remeron is a very sedating antidepressant. It's one of our more sedating ones. So if you're feeling kind of dull on this and not as perky as you used to be, that's something...
Well, I'm not on it. I can't be on it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I'm trying a bipolar meds now.
Uh-huh. Well, you know,
and,
I guess...
Your medication.
Let me say this to your questions, which I think are important ones. A lot of what we do is not only science, but it's a fairly large amount of art. The patients that come to me are not the patients that might be seen, for example, in the community by family practitioners who present for the first time with a relatively uncomplicated depression. The people that I see in my practice are often referred to me because they have more than one disorder. They have not responded to other treatments. And that takes a fair amount of patience on my part and the patients to be able to try different things. And I know that if I can try long enough, in almost all cases, I can find some symptom relief. But, as I said, it may take a fair amount of time and a fair large number of trials.
Right.
So that's the part I would want to leave you with, that it's not that we just have only one or two of these medicines. And we have old medicines that, when I was trained 25 years ago, are very, very helpful, but younger physicians don't use them anymore. So there are a lot of different options, and I would urge you not to give up on this and to try to find something, even in small doses. There's some people.
I've been working on it a long time.
I know, and you know.
But I am running into problems with the HMO.
I don't doubt that, and I. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, that's a major issue in healthcare right now. It's not only that people don't have insurance. But then
I have good insurance, but it's...
But it's undersured. I know. I'm agreeing with you.
My gastroenterologist just put me on Neurontin.
Uh-huh.
Because he thought it might help with... I've got some post-neuralgia from shingles.
Yes.
That's helped me a little bit with this depression thing.
Yes.
But I'm trying to manage it on my own because three pills a day are too much.
Sure.
So I'm going to get back to the psychiatrist. Too bad they can't coordinate more.
That's another major issue.
If you know, that's a problem.
Then you need to raise that issue with your physicians. They should be collaborating with each other around this because the Neurontin does have some psychological effects as well as the anti-pain effects. So when you go see the psychiatrist, I think it would be important that you ask for some coordination and collaboration between both.
Another problem is that I may have breast cancer, and I've been on estrogen and testosterone for mood elevation. It helps my moods.
Okay, well, you know, you've you've raised another issue, which is the segmentation of medical care in our country. It doesn't sound like there's one person that's in an overarching position to collaborate and coordinate all your care. Is that what you're telling me?
Right.
All right. Well, your internist or your family practitioner should take that role on. If you're seeing that many specialists, someone has to be at the helm of this ship, or else you're going to fall in the cracks.
Okay. And what's your name again?
It's Dr. Jerry Kay, K-A-Y.
K-N-Y?
K-A-Y, and I'm in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
But I would suggest that you're absolutely right. Coordination of your care is a critical issue.
All right. Well, again, I hope that that at least offers some help to the caller. We're coming into about our last 15 minutes. I should introduce again our guest, Gerald Kay. He's a physician. He's professor and chair of psychiatry at Wright State University. That's in Dayton, Ohio. We're talking this morning about the science of medication in treating mental illness, some of the potential benefits and potential downsides, side effects associated with these medications, and how they're managed by patients and doctors. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Back here to another caller in Champaign, and this would be line one. Hello.
Hi, great show. Want to compliment the guests and once again AM580 for discussing issues where people should be listening and talking about this. There's so much misinformation about psychiatry and mental health in general. gosh, so many things I'd like to say, but I'll just try to keep to two. I've probably had lifelong depression going back into my childhood, and been on antidepressant therapy, which is very effective. I'm very fortunate. I was a fast responder, and I've had a really good response. But I have a new primary care physician, and I like her a lot, but it's kind of funny. She keeps urging me to either lower my dose or to consider modifying it, and I don't know if there's some pressure at the institution she works for, which is a great medical unit, to just encourage people to get off medications. But it's kind of funny because I was off my medicine for a year and a half about 4 years ago, and it's not an experience I would ever care to repeat. So, but my question, you know, gosh, there's so many issues, or what I'd like you to comment on is the recovery movement. You've mentioned symptom management, which
right.
I think is important, and unfortunately the recovery movement got involved in all these other side issues about power and control and consumer treatment or something like that. But I think the recovery movement is a great thing because it's about finding purpose and meaning and accepting your life as it is with or without the medicine. In my own case, I've lost all this magical thinking, and I've lost all these connections, and I don't want to say I've had emotional flattening, but I've lost a lot of those magical emotions that I used to have from my depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's important to get out there and to not so much recover as discover. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on what goes on in the patient's life beyond taking medicine. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
Well, I must say I'm continually to be impressed with the sophistication of your audience, David. There are a couple of issues that we should address. As I mentioned earlier in the show, if the last caller has had a number of discrete episodes of depression, the studies are very clear that there are certain people that need to stay on their antidepressants for the rest of their life. And he may be one of those people. And the fact that he had a recurrence of symptoms after he stopped it 4 years ago might point to the notion that this is something that he ought to consider as a lifelong thing. If he's had three or four episodes of depression like this, I would not, if he were my patient, and I don't want to get in between the doctor-patient relationship now in Illinois, other than to say that if he has good symptom relief and he finds the medication helpful, then this is something he needs to lobby his primary care physician for strongly. It's different with someone who's had only a single episode of depression, where we know if we can keep someone on the medication for X number of months. I like to keep my patients on there for at least 6 to 12 months after they've become symptom-free, and then wean them off slowly. That is the kind of patient who can get off the antidepressant. But if they had multiple episodes throughout their life, I'm not going to mess with success. That's number one. Number two, the recovery is an important issue. It's a philosophical approach that speaks beyond the issue of symptom reduction. It talks about how to embrace a way of living that a person has not been able to because he or she's been under the trials and tribulations of the disorder prior to that. I don't have a great deal to add to your caller except to say I think he was right on in terms of talking about once the symptoms are relieved, how can you take the next step and begin to enjoy the world in a very different kind of way. I also want to comment on the fact that your caller did acknowledge that he had not only the depression but the obsessive compulsive disorder. That is another notoriously challenging disorder to treat, and those are not the kinds of patients that are likely to not need some medication for longer periods of time as well, because it can be a very disabling disease in addition to the depression.
All right. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's go on to someone else. This is also someone listening in Champaign. This is someone on line two right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about oh, I guess you could call them designer drugs, or how far are we into pharmacogenetics so that we can actually avoid all the trial and errors with all of these medications and maybe get to a class that's really going to work and not have the side effects for the patient?
Well, at the expense of sounding like I'm very boring, that is another sophisticated question. That's exactly where the field is at right now. We are looking at certain biological markers that would allow us to predict from blood tests what patient would respond to what drug best. And that's exactly where the field is right now. We're looking at certain kinds of neurotransmitter transporter systems, certain kinds of genetic configurations, and chromosome configurations. We are looking at ways of beginning to assess for what kind of patient is what treatment the best. And that's exactly where we are right now.
Knowing that these antidepressants don't work for everybody, one size doesn't fit all, and
right.
Knowing also that pain medicine doesn't, one size doesn't fit all,
mm-hmm.
There's got to be hopefully a genetic connection there where maybe one medication can help both depression and pain and chronic pain because they do go together.
Well, I think that's where the fields are going right now. There's no question that some people metabolize drugs very differently from others, okay? We've known that for a very, very long time. If the pain that you're referring to is really a sign or symptom of the depression, there is good evidence that some of the antidepressants, in fact, do help both. If the pain is due to other kinds of things, then a pain specialist is probably the person to contact. But you're right, at least at first blush, there are many kinds of pain issues that often are helped by using antidepressant medication.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
All thank
right.
you.
Thank you. We'll go next to line number 3. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, has there been an increase in mental health issues in the last 25 years or so? And if so, what do the causes seem to be? And then how much are doctors trying to apply, and does it help, more holistic approaches like how much does diet and exercise and stress influence as triggers to cause these diseases to show themselves or exacerbate the disease, that kind of thing?
Again, another sophisticated question. To make a very long story short, there is ample evidence to indicate that there's something called a cohort effect, C-O-H-O-R-T, meaning just a group effect, that if you look at the amount of depression that's taken place in our country over the last 50 years, you will see that more people become depressed after each generation. We're not sure what that's about, but it's a well-documented fact. The other issue is that, of course, our diagnostic and assessment tools are much, much more sophisticated than they were 50 years ago, so we may be picking up more cases right now. But I think you're absolutely right that, in general, there is, at least in the case of depression, an increasing number of people who are struggling with this. That is not true, for example, with schizophrenia, for example. The amount of people that get schizophrenia has remained very solid throughout the world. Now, as for the holistic approaches, this is an interesting area. As you know, more money is spent by people who go to holistic-oriented treatment situations than for physicians, believe it or not. It's an enormous industry. When it comes to psychiatric disorders, let me just say that there's not a lot of data to support some of this stuff. The issue of exercise, however, is supportable. We do know that, for example, it does decrease depression with exercise. We do know that some people do respond to diet in a different way. The issue of, for example, the big thing 7-8 years ago was St. John's wort with depression. We don't have any data at this point in time that that's really anything that is helpful with the treatment of depression. depression. So there are a lot of things that are out there in terms of alternative medicine, and a lot of people are looking at that to study to see what, in fact, is effective. But you should know that the data isn't overwhelming right now for many kinds of things. But the bottom line for me is if people find it helpful and they find it makes them feel better, then that's an important issue. And that has to be, you know, my guess is a lot of it has to do with the fact that people are given the adequate amount of time when they see alternative practitioners and there's a real engagement, an attempt to build a therapeutic alliance or working relationship between the patient and the caregiver. And that can be very profoundly moving as well.
All right. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me if I want to go and include one more caller in the time that remains. And this is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have a couple questions. One is about how mental illness is sometimes brought about by some traumatic stress, and then also a question about like self-medicating, because I know some people who attempt self-medication rather than going through, you know, because of some of the stigma that's attached to mental illness and actually going to and talking to a professional, that they start self-medicating, or even they don't know what they're going through and they self-medicate. And then the third question I have is about the military, where they tend to take people who, you know, if they're really backed up, if they really need people, they tend to lower their standards for who they actually recruit. And so they take people who have some problems to start with, expose them to stresses that are extraordinary, and then bring them home. And then there's not enough VA, you know, funds and stuff like that to provide help. And I guess I'll stop with this.
Yeah, because you've asked three very good questions,
yeah.
And three questions all that we could spend. Probably any one of those we could spend some time on. And unfortunately, Dr. K, we're down to the point where we have about 2 minutes.
Okay, very quickly. PTSD is something that is very treatable. We are much more knowledgeable about diagnosing and assessing it now. And I'm not only speaking about wartime issues or seeing someone shot. I'm talking about women who've been battered, who've been sexually abused. That's a very, very, very large part of the PTSD patients that I see. It's not the people returning from the Iraq. Self-medication is a very dangerous thing because most people self-medicate either with alcohol or illicit drugs. It's not the way to go, because if I can give you a golden rule of psychiatry, it is whatever you got that's wrong with you, if you add medicines like marijuana and cocaine and heroin and stuff like that, or hallucinogens, and or alcohol, it'll make things 100 times worse. Lastly, with respect to the military issue, there's ample evidence right now that we're seeing more and more young people coming back from these campaigns who are suffering from PTSD, and we do not have the service systems that are available to deliver the care they need.
Yeah, we have, again, maybe a minute or two. Forgive a question that I'm not going to be able to give you enough time to answer fully. However, it's something that I wanted to at least touch on, and it brings us around, in a sense, to where we started, and that is, how well do you think that colleges and universities are doing in meeting the challenge of providing mental health services for students?
Okay, well, you've asked me in 1 minute, and I'm going to put on my hat as chair of the American Psychiatric Association College Mental Health Committee. More students are asking for help now. More students are presenting with acute or serious disturbances than 25 years ago. More students are matriculating to college with mental disorders. And the college mental health centers are overwhelmed. Depression's doubled, suicide behavior's tripled, sexual assaults have quadrupled, 45% of students report self-depression, 10% of students report suicidal ideation, 44% binge drink. All of this is in the last 15 years.
Hmm.
We are being overwhelmed, and I have a lot of experiences in this area. There's simply not the resources because it's only, unfortunately, with all of this recent press in the last couple of years that people have realized, but they're mostly responded from a liability issue.
Yeah. And is it difficult to, do colleges and universities find it difficult to walk the line between the parents' expectations that the college is in loco parentis and also expectations that students or society might have that students are adults and they're supposed to be looking
out for
themselves?
David, this sounds like the next thing with me, okay? Because you just asked the whole hour on college health, the challenges of college health. And the answer is yes. I will tell you, having testified at the Virginia Tech panel, for the governor's panel, the thing that impressed me most was the confusion on the campuses for people that should know better between what's confidential and what's not confidential information. The federal laws as they exist do permit people to share information when a student is at great danger of harming themselves or others, and that includes with the parents as well as with the college administration. That's already there. But people have been so confused that they've been hiding behind this issue. Well, we don't want to tell anybody about it because it's a breach of confidentiality. That's not true. Number two, there is a fine line to walk. You don't want to get to the point where you increase stigma about students in college coming asking for services if they feel that there's no confidentiality, and that's the major dilemma.
Well, we'll have to stop there for now, but as you say, I think there are a number of issues we could discuss, and maybe if we could prevail on you to give us another hour of your time sometime, we could talk some more.
Good.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest again, Dr. Gerald Kay. He is professor and chair of psychiatry at Wright State University. That's in Dayton, Ohio.